This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 146 was recorded on December 20th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Prerequisite Capital CIO Daniel Wandt will join me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss Daniel's systems-based approach to analyzing over-the-count derivatives market impacts on financial markets. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview when Santiago Capital founder Brent Johnson will join us for an extended post-game segment where we'll discuss the Fed, the dollar, gold, and much more.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, before we get to the equities, let's touch on this week's FOMC rate hike. What's your take on it?
Patrick, the way I would describe this whole situation is the equity market was trying to bully the Fed into taking a more dovish stance in terms of monetary policy. And what I mean by that is the Fed really had potentially four steps that they could take. The previous guidance was everybody expected a rate hike this week, and of course we got one. And we've been given guidance to expect three more rate cuts next year. So the choices available to the Fed would be to stay exactly where they were and change nothing, or to go ahead with the rate hike this week and cut back to just two rate hikes next year. That's what they actually did. So they did take one step. But as far as going a step farther to say only one hike or no hikes next year or not even having the hike this week, they didn't do any of those things. So out of four potential steps to get more dovish, they only took one. So far, Jay Powell is keeping his word, which he started with when he took office, saying the Fed's job is not to bail out the stock market. Now, I think a lot of people didn't believe that. They're believing it now because the Fed has basically called the market's bluff and said, yeah, we're not going to change our policy just because the stock market is selling off. So that new guidance for two hikes in 2019 does not necessarily contradict our experts who have said that they predict zero, because I think if you'd ask Keith McCullough, okay, you're predicting no hikes. Do you think Jay Powell would say that? I'm sure he would probably say no. It doesn't mean Powell would say that. It just means Keith doesn't think there's actually going to be any more hikes. We'll wait and see what happens with the economy and how the Fed actually operates. But the takeaway message here is the assumption that the Yellen put is always in place to save the market. The Yellen put expired with Janet Yellen, and it has not been replaced by a Powell put. So I think it's time, Patrick, for everyone to come to terms with the fact that Jay Powell is serious about the Fed not being in the business of bailing out financial markets at the first sign of trouble.
Well, let's move on to the equity markets, because the reaction to the Fed was first beforehand, the market pops, and then a big sell-off afterwards. What's your take on how all of this is coming together for the equity markets?
Well, the sell-off before the FOMC was easily predictable. It was, as I said, kind of bullying the Fed. The sell-off that has happened afterwards is, in the way I think about it, is testing an exhaustion level. In other words, okay, the Fed was clearly not as dovish as a lot of people expected and hoped for. Oh my gosh, the sky is falling. The world's coming to an end. Everybody sell, 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 sell. And usually what happens under those circumstances is you get to an exhaustion level where everybody who wanted to sell has done their selling, and you end up actually getting a pretty significant relief rally after that. It feels to me, Patrick, like Thursday afternoon, we saw that moment where we reached an exhaustion level. And I think we're probably about to start a healthy bounce that could last easily into January, if not further into 2019. But I see this, you know, the way this looks to me, it's a setup for one of two things to happen. If what we're going to see and what I'm expecting is that the sky is falling mentality kind of wears off and people realize it got a little bit overdone and ahead of itself, you see a rally that probably takes us into the beginning of next year. Whenever that thing tops, I want to be selling that, because I do think that the major trend has changed to downward. But frankly, the other thing is, if we were setting up for an outright crash, it would look just like this. And what you would see is that bottom that we sort of saw on Thursday afternoon doesn't hold, and we just keep going down and down and down, and it becomes a vicious cycle at that point. You know, we'll see what happens. But I think, Patrick, that what's more likely to happen is a vicious bear market rally. And I know from reading your Sunday note to Big Picture Trading listeners, you were looking for an exhaustion low. I'm guessing you guys are probably long at this point. How do you see this market?
Well, we were targeting another wave of selling here, but yeah, buying the dip is actually on our list. Now, there's always a chance that this could just spiral out of control. You can never rule that out, because when everyone's on the wrong side of the trade and they all run for the exit door, sometimes these liquidity events are harder to gauge. But generally, we are very oversold. And more importantly, a lot of our technical levels we were looking for are all being achieved. So while I'm certainly bearish in the much bigger picture, you know, that's something me and you talked about numerous times over the last year, about this being a bigger topping formation. But just like you, I think I share your sentiments that that at some point here we're going to have a trading low, and maybe we'll be rallying into Christmas, but maybe that's asking too much. We'll certainly see. Anyway, let's move on to the US dollar. Now, I'll tell you, I wasn't expecting this kind of a reaction to dollar. I actually thought the dollar would have rallied on the Fed. Maybe you have an insight for that. What's your take on why the dollar is down today?
Well, it's perplexing. I was, as you said, expecting, since the Fed has basically stuck to their guns, and they didn't say they're going to keep 3 rate hikes next year, but they're still telling us 2 rate hikes next year, that I thought would continue to support dollar bullishness. But certainly the dollar index is down considerably, and I think it has to do with exactly which currency pairs are there, because the dollar was weak compared to, for example, the Chilean peso today. So it's a question of where that action is concentrated. This point, this weakness that we're seeing in the dollar, it does kind of concern me, because I wasn't expecting it. Just as you're saying, given what happened at the Fed, I would expect the dollar to be fairly strong at this point. And we saw a pretty significant move down. But from a technical standpoint, it's not time to panic yet. We can get another full big handle lower before we've really broken to the downside out of this consolidation range that we've been in for several weeks. I was surprised, though. Like you, I thought we were headed to the upside. I definitely want to tap Brent Johnson for his view in the postgame segment. His work centers on the dollar, and it's going to be very interesting to see what he thinks about this development.
Well, let's move on to crude oil, because the carnage continues. If there's any one market that appears almost weaker than the stock market, it's oil. Did Tuesday's massive sell-off surprise you, and what do you see next?
No, it didn't surprise me at all, and I don't think it's over yet. There has been a perfect storm of factors around inventory, Iran sanctions, so on and so forth. But I really think the big one is uncertainty about how willing or able Saudi Arabia is to support prices in the wake of the Jamal Khashoggi murder debacle. It's very clear that President Trump is pressuring them to allow oil prices to come down. And although they did finally, after a fashion with a fair amount of argument with Iran, they finally managed to pull this production cut out of the table. But already people are questioning everyone's commitment to compliance with that cut. If the stock market doesn't find a short-term bottom soon and really start selling off, well, things could get really, really ugly, because that would portend serious economic difficulty and just fuel the selling in the stock market. When we finally do reach a bottom, though, and I think it could still be quite a few dollars lower, I wouldn't be surprised if we hit $40 or even mid to high 30s before this selling is over. I think it's going to be the buying opportunity of a lifetime. And I don't think it necessarily comes right away. It may take getting into a recession cycle before we see the final low. But when we get to the low on this cycle, I really feel that in a much longer time frame picture, all of the lack of investment of the last 5 years is eventually going to come back and bite us. And we're getting to a point now at these prices where it's going to cause a huge cessation of further investment in the shale patch, at least temporarily, until prices start to recover. So eventually, I think there's going to be a moonshot to the upside in prices. But right now, I think the downtrend is very strong, set to continue, and I won't be surprised if we have further to go. Wednesday's action to the upside was really not so much about inventory, but an OPEC statement talking about extending the cut that was just announced beyond April. So the inventory didn't really affect the tape as much. Crude oil did draw down 497,000 barrels. quite a bit less than the 2.5 to 3.5 million barrel drawdown that analysts had expected. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 1.1 million barrels. Gasoline, building 1.8 million barrels. The big drawdown was distillates, down 4.2 million barrels. Remember, though, we just had a great big build of 3.8 a few weeks ago, so there's been a lot of volatility in the distillates number. Production unchanged at 11.6 million barrels. Exports still 2.3 million barrels, and that, again, that's 16 million barrels on the week. Genscape is already reporting a 1.8 million barrel week-on-week build in Cushing, Oklahoma as of Tuesday, so that suggests that more builds are still in the making, although those Genscape reports are based on a thermal imaging camera, which is not super accurate. So we'll see what next week's inventory brings, but I think we've got room to go further to the downside. I'm really starting to think about the long-term strategic play. I think the bottom that's coming, and I don't mean tomorrow or next week, but when we actually get to a bottom in this market, potentially in a recession cycle, I think it's going to set up just an incredible buying opportunity.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold. We printed 1270 on an intraday basis, and we're certainly now trading at multi-month highs. What's driving this?
Well, Patrick, it has really surprised me because my expectation after the FOMC statement was, okay, they only took one step out of four possible steps toward a more dovish stance. So many people were expecting something more dovish. They ended up going more hawkish. I thought that should hurt gold prices, but we've actually seen a pretty good rally. And of course, that rally was coincident with what was unexpected, at least by you and me, of weakness in the dollar in the wake of the FOMC. So it's really interesting, regardless of what's driving it, we're seeing strength in gold that I was not expecting. For a long time, I really felt like I had my pulse on the gold market. I kind of knew what it was going to do next without looking, and it has really been surprising me lately with unexpected strength. I really want to tap Brent Johnson about this because he is a long, long-time gold bull, but he's had reservations, as I've had, about whether or not it's really time for gold yet, and I still have those reservations, but frankly, the market is looking like it wants to prove me wrong. Now, we're back down to 1260 as we're recording right around the close on Thursday. Nomura's model shows about 1270 as the CTA model where they would flip to a more bullish stance. So we haven't quite seen that inflection point on the CTA model, but I really want to get Brent's views in the postgame segment and see what he thinks, because as much as I see lots of reasons that gold shouldn't be doing this, it is doing this, and that really says something.
Well, Eric, I wanted to talk to you about these 10-year Treasury yields. Now, you've been talking about this 280 level quite a bit. We closed yesterday below 280, but we're closing right at 280 again right now as we're recording. What's your take here? What comes next on interest rates?
Well, Patrick, I thought Stan Druckenmiller's interview on Bloomberg was really fascinating. We've got that linked in your research roundup email. Just to summarize, Stan really likes shorter-term treasuries from the long side as a play in a bear market, and he prefers it over shorting stock market indices because stock market indices tend to be prone to vicious bear market rallies, and furthermore, you don't really see that action at the front of the curve until the Fed starts to take action, which, of course, hasn't happened yet. So I thought that was a fascinating idea in fixed income. But as far as the 10-year is concerned, as much as Keith McCullough from HedgEye nailed it back on November 15th when we had him on the program, I think it's probably too late to get in on the long side of this trade. We've come all the way from 325 down below 280 today. 260 would be a key support level to watch. I don't want to trade those last 15 basis points or whatever is left after how much it's moved. And as far as breaking 260, that's certainly possible, but I'd want to see what happens there first. So I feel like it's too late for this 10-year trade, but I'm starting to look at the 2-year trade.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Now, before we move on to this week's featured interview, we have a few housekeeping items. What's going on?
Patrick, this will be our last regular format show for the 2018 season. Next week, we're going to be bringing you a special format. Our year-end special show is going to feature clips from all of the best interviews that we did in 2018. We'll be comparing the predictions that our guest made with what actually happened in the marketplace. So look forward to that one. We'll be back to our regular schedule on January 3rd. Meanwhile, we've also published the full schedule for our live event in Vancouver on January 19th. That's up on the website. It's also linked in your Research Roundup email. And finally, Macro Voices is brought to you by the generosity of listeners like you through your donations. So if you've enjoyed Macro Voices this year, we hope that you'll consider making a donation this holiday season.
Thanks, Eric. And so this week's featured interview guest is Prerequisite Capital co-founder and CIO Daniel Want. Eric's interview with Daniel is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Daniel Want, co-founder and CIO at Prerequisite Capital in Australia. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us on the program. I want to start with your overall view of the market because you take a different approach than other people. You apply systems analysis to financial markets. What specifically do you mean by systems or system thinking, and how does that play into the way that you approach markets generally?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Eric. Basically, the majority of us are trained when we go through university or even in a lot of the more conventional and institutional sort of career paths or fields of study, especially in economics and finance, to think effectively in quite a linear, reductionist type, mechanical sort of manner. When we talk about a systems view of the world, what it kind of is doing is shifting our view of the world from the world operating as a machine towards the world operating as a living, ecological style, adaptive system. So it's kind of, drawing on a lot of lessons from, complex adaptive system theory and just trying to better understand the interconnectedness, how everything fits together, the knock-on effects, the relationships, the adaptive nature of all of these relationships and things and how it all transitions. So instead of looking at, for example, a subsystem or a company or, in this case, we're going to be talking a little bit about banks. Instead of looking at a bank in isolation through a reductionist sort of mechanical view of the world, where we're trained to basically look at capital adequacy ratios and all of this sort of thing at the bank in isolation, what we're more interested in when we look at the banks, for example, from a systems perspective, is the interconnectedness risks of that bank as a subsystem within a broader system. And so we're more interested in sort of that web of relationships, the impacting flows and the interconnectedness risks that puts that balance sheet at risk and, that either will present tailwinds or headwinds to that balance sheet. So when we look at a systems view, we're stepping right back, looking at how everything interrelates with everything else from a quantitative point of view. If we're looking at the world as through our more conventional reductionist lens, ultimately we're making assumptions around, return distributions and all of this sort of thing, that probability distributions will be somewhat stable. Whereas in a systems view of the world, we are more attuned to understand how the system is functioning and self-reinforcing with feedback loops and when that system breaks down and transitions into different regimes. And when that happens, those normal or those statistical distribution functions that we're assuming will tend to shift, and then we get fat tails, and it's a very dynamic and evolving sort of set of circumstances.
I want to pick up on the theme that you mentioned around interconnectedness and interdependency. Because if I look at something like the OTC derivatives market, there's just trillions and trillions of dollars of these things. And the academic view is almost, everybody's got to be on one side or the other, so it all nets out to a zero-sum game. But when you look at this from a systems perspective, what risks exist as a result of all of the over-the-counter derivatives that are in existence and all of the exposures that so many financial institutions are exposed to in the system?
Yeah, precisely. Obviously, there's quite a significant discussion we're about to have on these topics. But part of the system's view of those interconnected risks is sort of understanding how when you get groups of actors all pursuing their own self-interest, seemingly independently of one another, when you combine all of those actors and participants together, quite often you can actually get emergent type phenomena where the overall behavior of all of these people in aggregate start to have materially different characteristics to them. And so all of these people in isolation, you know, when the academic world looks at derivatives and even the regulators to a certain degree, they really take to an extreme the whole zero-sum sort of theoretical foundation of the derivative world where, you know, you have a winning side and a losing side, it all washes out and overall there's not really any risk. It's sort of the extreme view on things. In practice, however, both sides have to start provisioning balance sheet capacity to be able to actually even play the game and sustain any form of derivative exposures. And so when we step back and look at the realities around both the size of what is going on in especially the over-the-counter derivative world, and then the nature of the activities of all of these different participants, we also start to basically start to see some dynamics which in some ways are hiding in plain sight, but I believe are quite underappreciated by investors and market participants generally. There's one thing we probably need to touch on, and that's just some of the incentives around, say, the, you know, the banking industry versus the regulators and all of this sort of thing. Now, the OTC, over-the-counter derivatives, essentially are nothing but betting slips on future price movement of certain financial metrics, whether they be markets or all sorts of things. Now, the banks for the last decade or so, you know, since 2008 especially, their fundamental business model has been, you know, suffering from a whole variety of headwinds that have been pressuring their earnings, return on assets, return on equity, all of these sort of things. Everything from issues around net interest margins to compressing credit spreads to increased regulatory sort of requirements where they're needing to boost capital buffers, all kind of putting headwinds on their return profile. The only area where they kind of have a little bit of a give or some flexibility in terms of driving earnings and even earnings growth, and we're talking about, you know, the 12 to 15 of the major banks in the world that account for the majority of this over-the-counter derivative activity, and these tend to be the largest banks in the world anyway. From a bank's perspective, when they are dealing in over-the-counter derivatives, you know, they're essentially the bookmaker. Because of the way the academic world and even the regulatory world view over-the-counter derivatives, especially this netted version of a zero-sum risk in the system, and the way accounting works and all of this sort of stuff, when the banks are dealing in and selling basically over-the-counter derivative instruments, you know, they call it them securities, but really all they are just betting slips, right? They're just contracts, not much more than just a wagering operation. When they sell these things, it has minimal balance sheet sort of impact. In fact, most of it hits their P&L in terms of fees and commissions and all of this sort of thing. Because of the accounting and the regulatory framework that we have, and, you know, in some ways, the right, you know, rightly viewing a lot of this stuff through a netted perspective in that reductionist isolated sort of sense. And so bankers can actually drive earnings by just selling more of these things, and all of this over-the-counter derivative activity more so hits their P&L, and it's incredibly profitable activity. A lot of this stuff goes straight to the bottom line and it has minimal implications for their balance sheets. And so they've got huge incentives, and a lot of the earnings, the only way a lot of these banks have really been able to maintain their earnings profile and even see a little bit of growth in this, in earnings, and, you know, so bankers hitting bonus targets and all of this sort of stuff, is in this over-the-counter derivative world. The other complicating factor is that because a lot of these over-the-counter derivative instruments and the uses beyond just speculating on financial market prices and movements and things, you can use over-the-counter derivatives to synthetically recreate funding arrangements. And so you know, bankers, and there's been lots of anecdotal evidence, and there's a lot of incentives for different types of businesses to recreate off-balance sheet style funding arrangements, liabilities, and basically playing games to game the system, especially under existing accounting standards and treatments and regulatory frameworks. And so the risks, in addition to issues around maturity matching, where they're effectively funding long duration assets with shorter duration sort of funding structures using combinations of derivatives and wholesale funding market sort of instruments and all sorts of things that are not necessarily fully appearing on balance sheets, both in banking and financial system realms, and then also in the real world, in normal businesses, even government entities, you know, have been caught out playing games, like, for example, in Greece and the Goldman Sachs sort of debacle that unfolded there.
Daniel, let's come back to the subject of netting versus gross exposures and how much risk exists there, because I think it's something that's really not discussed very much. All these banks will tell you, well, look, we're $99 gazillion short something, but we're also $99.1 gazillion long the same thing, because we're market makers and that's what we do, and it's not a big deal. It all nets out. It's no problem. Net, net, there's not that much risk. The problem that that ignores is if one of the counterparties fails and all of the sudden some of that exposure is absolute and it doesn't really have the hedge that they think they have, all of a sudden they've got a huge uncovered risk. How realistic is that scenario where one of their counterparties fails in a way that creates a systemic risk? And is there a risk of that cascading through the system and magnifying to the point where it becomes a systemic risk to the overall financial system?
Yes, well, you're right. Now, one of the responses to the 2008 financial crisis, where clearly deficiencies around counterparty risk and all of this sort of stuff really came to the surface, is the regulatory response. Part of it has been trying to move the over-the-counter derivative world towards centralized clearinghouses to put a counterparty in between all of these other counterparties to manage the counterparty risk. You know, even just this month, the Bank of International Settlements put out in their quarterly review, you know, had quite a reasonable article in there actually starting to raise concerns and doubts around the abilities of the centralized clearing parties and operations, because we've already started to see incidences where, you know, the reserves of these centralized clearinghouses almost being wiped out. And we're not even in stressed conditions now, albeit the examples that they were citing were derivatives relating to fairly illiquid sort of exposures. But nonetheless, there's sort of already concerns and cracks appearing with the whole theory around moving towards these centralized clearing parties. And so it's a step in the right direction, but when you really dive into the realities of how it works and how they calculate and drive the margining requirements, it's it falls massively short of the intended objectives of the regulatory sort of push. Now, there's a sort of a second issue embedded in the question that you were sort of referring to around netting. And, you know, a lot of when you look at the derivatives picture, the over-the-counter derivatives picture, most people are looking at that picture from the perspective of the banks, right? It's like in gambling terms, it's you're looking at the picture from the perspective of the bookie or the bookmaker, right? And, you know, everything nets out, right? They make sure it nets out and, you know, they capture a spread and they make their money as in running the book. And so that's why people tend to just worry about the netted terms. They dismiss the gross value, the gross market value of derivative exposures that are out there. But when you look at it from non-bank participant perspective, so when you step back to look at the broader system of all of the participants out there operating in the, you know, over-the-counter derivative markets, you know, and evidence seems to suggest that the bulk of over-the-counter derivative activity is actually either directly or indirectly for speculative purposes, right? It's not in reality a useful economic hedging function like it's sort of marketed to be. The bulk of activity is actually speculatively driven. Now, when we step back, the Bank of International Settlements probably provide the most reliable estimates of derivative exposures and activity out there. Every 6 months, they survey the world and basically publish a lot of statistics around these things. And three of the headline statistics that they tend to publish, obviously, there's the notional derivative exposures that everyone's kind of heard about, where we have something like, I think it's 595 or roughly trillion US dollars worth of notional exposure of derivative contracts out there. Then a second item that they tend to identify is a line item called gross market value. So the gross market value of derivatives basically measures, because there's two sides to every derivative exposure, you've got the side that is basically in the money and the side that's basically out of the money or losing money. And so there's what they call gross positive market values and gross negative market values. And so that's really just saying, this is loosely, if we were to shut down the trade today, what the value of the, you know, say the margin transfer or the money flow, roughly speaking, between the two derivative parties that are involved, remembering that the bank in substance is a bookie type facilitator of this activity, as opposed to, you know, they obviously take directional risk and outright sort of exposures to derivatives. But in this instance, we're more talking about these non-bank participants. The BIS produced these estimates of measurements of the gross market values, which are an absolute combination of all the positive market values out there versus all the negative ones. And they add them together. So it's an absolute aggregate of these, the two sides of the trade. And what this, that effectively in substance, when you sort of strip it all back to what the heck does that really mean? Those gross market values are effectively like the balance sheet capacity that participants who are operating in the derivative world are having to provision, like a margin to put up to be able to sustain those notional exposures. Now, both parties, even the party that's in the money, because there's a lot of moving parts in the derivative world, and frankly, volatilities change, and over the, you know, on a forward-looking basis, even the party that's in the money is still at risk of swinging out of the money, right? And so they're still having to put and provision balance sheet capacity against these notional exposures. So anyway, when we step back functionally in the broader system, we have an estimate of the margining and balance sheet requirements of that broader system has to put up to sustain these notional exposures. And that's in the aggregated gross market value figures that we see. Now, in a perfect world where we didn't have a lot of pro-cyclical moving parts like haircuts on collateral, rehypothecation rates, and et cetera, a lot of technical sort of dynamics, if we didn't have all of those moving parts, maybe we could take, say, 50 to 60% of that gross market value estimate and allocate that as the sort of margining requirements to sustain the notional over-the-counter exposures that the world have. But in reality of the sort of volatilities out there of markets and potential volatilities that we've experienced in broader history, and the fact that we do have a very cyclical set of moving parts in terms of collateral haircuts that is used and posted for margining requirements and all of this sort of stuff, the actual reality of the margining requirements in the broader system to sustain those notional exposures is more towards, say, 70 to 100% of that gross market value that is reported by the BIS. So that gives us a bit of a summary, a rough estimate of the margining requirements out there in the broader system, in the broader world, of what it takes to sustain the notional exposures. And that tends to correlate, as we'll see soon, with capital market implied volatilities and movements, mainly because a lot of those margining requirements are calculated as a derivative of, say, what they call value at risk or VAR models, which are all kind of derivatives of how volatile are markets out there. The more volatile, the more margin and balance sheet capacity we have to put up. And the less volatile, the less margin and cash collateral and balance sheet capacity we need to provision to sustain these exposures. And the swings in those margining requirements, they're one of the most material determinants of how much liquidity is in the broader global financialized system. Right. And we're going to get into some charts now to actually have a look at what this all practically looks like. Now, we'll jump through these charts selectively and pretty quickly because there's a lot of information here, and this chart deck that we're providing here is really best studied later on if you're so interested. But, Eric, let's jump into some of the charts, hey?
Listeners, you'll find two downloads linked in your Research Roundup email. There's both a PowerPoint presentation and a longer, more detailed book of charts. I encourage you to spend time going through both of those. Daniel's provided a fantastic wealth of knowledge that goes well beyond the amount of time we have for today's interview. But just to get some highlights, Daniel, in your PowerPoint presentation, let's look at slide 15, where you talk about OTC derivatives from a systems perspective. What is this slide about?
Well, on slide 15 here, we can see basically a really rough approximate gauge of what we'll loosely just call the margining requirements on that outstanding exposure of over-the-counter derivatives. So labeled A here, that's the notional exposure, and at the moment it's almost $600 trillion. But in blue, with the right-hand scale, it's actually the gross market values that we were just talking about before. When you divide the gross market value by the notional, that gives us probably the best rough estimate or proximate sort of view on what the margining requirements, you know, how much balance sheet capacity in the world is effectively being tied up to be able to sustain these over-the-counter notional exposures. And so there's a few sort of technical things which have caused a few different trends in these things. But the key takeaway is that we're now at lower margining requirements on this big pile of derivative exposures than we've ever been, lower than 2007 even. And you'll see on the next slide we'll probably jump over to, on slide 18, the 2008 global financial crisis effectively was a globalized scramble for cash and collateral. So it was like a big margin call. And because we can sort of measure these things in a rough sort of way with these Bank of International Settlement statistics, you know, Keynes used to say it's better to be roughly right than precisely wrong. Well, this is a roughly right type of analysis from a systems view. In 2008, from the lows in 2007, we can see that increase in margining requirements was actually a $24 trillion US scramble for cash and collateral. And that more or less wiped out in the GFC overall $26 trillion off the value of global equity markets, right? And so really what that was is a system-wide margin call where the volatilities in markets started to escalate, funding costs in wholesale dollar markets and the shadow bank world started to escalate, and we got a scramble for cash and collateral. So all of this under-provisioned sort of balance sheets in the world of these broader non-bank participants all of a sudden had to raise liquidity and provide balance sheet capacity to try and meet basically the margin call that was unfolding on their notional derivative exposures. And that meant selling everything else in order to raise liquidity wherever they could. And that was effectively triggering off that reflexive deflationary shock that we saw in 2008. And obviously, when liquidity really recedes, it exposes the weakest areas first. And that's where we get the symptoms of a lot of these broader dynamics occurring in the form of like the issues in the mortgage-backed securities markets and all of the popular understandings of what 2008 was.
Daniel, slide 19, give us the bottom line here on what this is telling us.
Okay, so right now we're at all-time lows in margining requirements in the world on $600 trillion worth of notional exposure. And so if we were to, you know, just move back to, say, the mean, or we actually have a reflexive event trigger in the world that sees volatility reflexively feeding on itself and basically a liquidity shock in the world, that step up in margining requirements on that notional exposure amounts to effectively between a $8 to $25 trillion margining call or margin call and scramble for cash and collateral. So that's one hell of a bid for both ultimately US dollars, anything that serves as collateral, especially the higher quality collateral like treasuries, and all of that sort of thing. Now, it doesn't mean it'll be triggered tomorrow, but this is one of the risks lurking beneath the surface. And when we analyze global system liquidity, this is probably one of the biggest stories that no one is really paying proper attention to. So it's well worth looking into all of this for yourself.
Needless to say, Daniel, there's so much more, a wealth of information in these two very substantial downloads that you've very thoughtfully made available to our listeners. Again, folks, that's in your Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, you can find a button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Daniel's picture on our homepage. Daniel, we're going to have to leave it there, but for our listeners who are interested in following your work and learning more about what you do at Prerequisite Capital, how can they contact you?
It's best to just jump on our website, so www.prerequisite.com.au, and basically they can find out a little bit more about what we do. There's some samples on there and of our research and all of that sort of thing. So always happy to have a chat with anyone, and thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks so much. We appreciate your time, Daniel. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, what a great interview with Daniel. I wanted to keep things rolling. Joining us here in the post game is Brent Johnson from San Diego Capital. How's it going, Brent?
Hey, good. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to talking to you guys.
Great. So, Brent, listen, when we had Daniel on the show and for that recording, it was actually prior to the Fed and Powell comments during the press conference. So you are joining us here now. We're several hours after the fact. And really, I wanted to just get your first impression. What just happened and what's your take on the Fed minutes?
Yeah, well, for me, it was pretty much as expected, to be honest. I've been in the camp that they were going to raise four times this year since the beginning of the year. And, you know, I've said that on several occasions. But what we basically got to today, based on the market actions over the, let's call it the last 2 to 3 months, I think many in the market, you know, the expectations for Fed hikes came down. Many in the market were expecting, I think, if not a full reversal, at least, a dovish tilt from Powell. And I think he did do that. I think he did walk it back a little bit from where he was in October, but nowhere near what I think many in the market were either wanting or expecting. And so the reaction post the announcement and his press conference, I think, is kind of apropos to that. From my perspective, it made sense for him to back off a little bit from being this hawkish, but still maintaining the current path. And that's basically kind of what I expected to happen. So from my perspective, it's kind of still going as I thought it would.
Brent, I want to pick up on that, specifically reference the U.S. dollar, because I know that's where a lot of your work focuses. Now, obviously, we got this reaction from the FOMC today, which says, okay, instead of 3 rate hikes, they're now saying 2 rate hikes. So they're not going to 0 rate hikes the way some people thought they would. But what I want to ask you is, whenever they do eventually pause, whether that's 2 more hikes or 3 more hikes or no more hikes, when it becomes clear to the market that the Fed has actually paused its rate hiking cycle, a whole lot of people are absolutely convinced that that can only mean one thing. It's got to be a U-turn for the U.S. dollar index straight down at that point. I'm not persuaded of that. What's your view, and how far could it go in either direction? Which way do you think it's going to go, and what do you expect once we get to the eventual pause, whenever that comes?
First of all, I think it's going to take longer to get to the pause than most people think it's going to. But it will happen at some point. And I think when it initially happens, most likely the dollar will sell off. But I don't expect that sell off to last long, because even if they back off, it's because things have gotten materially worse, right? And the way I see it is the dollar gets stronger under either scenario, because if things get worse and the Fed actually has to reverse course and maybe even lower interest rates or, you know, cut way back on their plan, the QT, that's an indication that not only is the global market in trouble, but the U.S. market is in trouble. And if that happens, I think the dollar, while it will sell off initially, but it will ultimately, I believe, get a safe haven trade. If you look around the world, the United States is either the number one, the number two, or the number three customer for the rest of the world, right? And if you think of Pareto's principle, and this is the same in my business, it may be the same in your business, is, you know, 20% of the clients make up 80% of the revenue. I don't know any business that can lose their number one, number two, or number three customer and not have it materially impact themselves. So if the U.S. goes into a recession or goes down in some form, I think that's bad for emerging markets. I think that's bad for China. I think it's bad for Europe. I think it's bad for the whole world. And on a relative basis, even if we start to go down, I think we still look better than the rest of the world. And under that scenario, because we're still on a dollar payment system, because we're still on a dollar standard, until that changes, I think the dollar gets safe haven flows. So I would expect a pause from the Fed to be initially bearish for the dollar, but I don't think it lasts long.
So Brent, I have to ask you, you're bullish here on the dollar. And clearly the first reaction of the dollar was to strengthen after the FOMC. If we do break out to a fresh high from this consolidation level, just under 98 on the Dixie, where do you think the dollar's going? And your answer could be either short term or over the longer term.
Well, I think if we get a weekly and certainly a monthly close above 98, I think it's going to jump to 100 really quickly. Maybe even, you know, go back to the highs from early 2017, 102, 103 area. Ultimately, I think it's going much, much higher. And, you know, I always kind of hesitate to give predictions and forecasts and stuff, because you ultimately end up getting hate mail, for lack of a better word, whenever you say these things. But I just think that the dollar's headed back to its all-time highs, back to the highs that we've seen in the mid-80s. And I know many people just don't think that can happen. And I understand all the arguments why it shouldn't happen. I understand all the arguments how it would be horrible for the world. But just because it would be bad for the world doesn't mean it can't happen. And from all my analysis, the only way it doesn't happen is if the Fed or the president or some monetary authority proactively acts against dollar strength. And I don't mean just saying something. I mean actually going out there and instituting some policy to purposefully weaken it, whether it's another Plaza Accord type thing or whether it's a negotiated treaty with the other countries. But I just think that when this whole thing plays out, that the global monetary system is going to die from a strong dollar, not a weak dollar.
Brent, I want to stay on this idea. I agree with you. I think there's a lot of reasons that it could go higher, but I want to understand your reasons. Let's suppose that there's all of those good arguments where people are saying, look at this de-dollarization trend. Look at how much effort China's putting into this yuan-denominated contract, trying to get the world off the petrodollar system, trying to reduce the amount of dollar-denominated trade settlements that occur. There's a lot of people trying pretty hard to ditch the dollar around the world, and they're not going to get rid of it overnight, but certainly the trend is starting to move in that direction. And you're still saying all-time highs like we had in the 80s in the face of those things. So what is the mechanism that you think gets us there specifically?
Well, there's several, but the biggest mechanism that I see is the dollar-based debt in the world. And a lot of people will talk about the positioning of the dollar trade is way overdone on the bullish dollar side. But when you think of that, you're really just looking at the CFTC futures trading data. That is in the face of an enormous fundamental dollar short based on all the dollar debt in the world. Now, everybody knows that the United States has an enormous amount of dollar debt, 21 or 22 trillion at this point. You add another 10 to 12 trillion in our banking system, we're up to 30, 35. But what many people forget is that there's $11 trillion of dollar-based debt issued by entities outside the United States who don't have the dollar as their home currency. So if you add up all this dollar debt, whether it's U.S. debt or outside the United States debt, you quickly get, and if you assume that all of that debt has the average interest rate of the outstanding U.S. Treasury, which is 2.35%, you still get to a number of $1 trillion a year in interest payments just to service the dollar debt. Now, that is essentially demand for dollars. It's future demand for dollars. You have to get the dollars to service that debt, and then you have to get the dollars to pay off that debt. And there's just not that as many dollars being produced, and there's not as many dollars being exported as there used to be. And so it really comes down, as anything in economics does, comes down to supply versus demand. Now, many people will say to me, yes, Brent, but all they have to do is turn on the printing press. They print, 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 and supply goes up, and it's no problem. And I always come back and say, yes, that is true. But what makes them print is pain. They don't just go out and print for the hell of it. And what pain is caused by is a stronger dollar. So If the dollar gets too strong and our domestic market weakens as a result, then they will maybe do that. But until then, they're not going to do that. And I think Powell was pretty clear today that he doesn't even see that in the future. You know, he stayed fairly on his hawkish path. He's a little bit more dovish than he was a month or so ago. But, you know, I didn't see him as wavering from his path a whole lot.
Now, Brent, you're going to be speaking at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference, and you're going to be talking about gold, or at least there's going to be a lot of conversations about gold over there. Now, this bullish dollar view you have, at least from a natural intermarket relationships, would imply a negative gold price. Do you still view gold bearishly here, or do you think that this is a buy on dip here?
Well, no, I don't think it's a buy on dip. And, you know, I always have to kind of set this up and say that, you know, I'm a huge proponent of gold. If you look back over the last 5 to 6 years, there's few people who've put out more material extolling the benefits of having gold in a portfolio than I have. I'm a huge believer that everybody owns it, and I think it's an essential part of a portfolio. Where I come across a little different than most people in the gold world is I'm not always gold bullish. Just because I think it's important to have an insurance policy does not think that I think it's going to always pay off the next day. And I just think that we're in a place where gold is not yet ready to break out and move to its all-time highs. I am absolutely certain that that is going to happen in the years ahead. There's no question in my mind. You know, I have this little tagline that says, if you believe in math, buy gold. Because if you believe in math, the monetary system is on a path that is just not sustainable. And I can't go into all the reasons why that is, but that's just the way it is. And when that comes under pressure, then gold is going to do very, very, very well. But I just don't think that we're there yet. And so I actually think today's rally in gold early and subsequent sell-off was, I don't want to say the kiss of death necessarily, but that was not a bullish sign for me. I actually didn't think that gold was going to rally as much as it did over the last couple of months. I thought it could rally up to the 1260, 1270 area. I didn't think it would, but I thought if it did, that would be where it stalled out. And that's exactly what happened today. And I don't know whether gold's going to fall a lot from here, but I don't think that it's ready to break out yet. And, you know, with what I see happening to the dollar over the next year or two, I'm not sure that gold's going to break out for another couple of years. Now, again, I'm not telling people to go out and sell gold. I think it's an important part of an overall portfolio. I just don't see it the same way that a lot of other people in the gold world do.
Brent, I know you look at gold real closely, so I want to ask you if, you know, because our views are so similar. Everything you just said is exactly consistent with what I was saying before October 11th, which is, look, folks, I'm a big believer in gold long term. I'm sure it's going to have its day in the sun. I don't think it's yet, and I think it might be a while. I think this dollar going up has got to play out first, and I think it could be a big move ahead of us. And I said exactly the same things. And what really caught my eye was on October 11th, there was a sudden break of correlations where all of a sudden gold and the Chinese yuan were no longer trading in lockstep the way they had been. We saw several days where gold and the dollar index are going up on the same day, which is very much out of character with how it had been for months and months before that. Do you have any theories? I mean, I'm still with you that I'm skeptical that it's time yet, but something seems to be going on that I know for certain I cannot explain. Can you explain what's happened since October 11th?
Well, you know, I can't really explain it. I mean, there's this old saying that there's only two people who really understand gold and they don't agree. And so I can't say for certain. I will tell you that I was never one of the people who, you know, earlier this year, let's call it from late last year to this year through 3 or 4 months ago, the newest thing in the gold world was that China is in control of the gold price. You just look at the correlation of the yuan to gold, and it's so close, it can't be anything other than China's controlling the price of gold. And to be honest, I just never bought it. Now, could it be true? Sure, it could be true. I didn't see enough evidence of it other than just the correlation. And, you know, I'm not a believer that correlation necessarily means causation. Even if it was correlated, I don't think China's in control of anything, let alone gold. And I think, you know, the yuan, a lot of that is, you know, it's just moving in counterstep to the dollar as well. So for a long time, gold was, you know, just moving in an opposite direction of the dollar. And I actually believe that we're going to get into a period of time where the dollar and gold will rise together. I don't think we're there yet. I think the dollar is going to break out first. I think that's going to put a lot of pressure on gold. I think the strong dollar, though, is going to start wrecking the monetary system. I think there will be a period of time, and I don't know whether that period of time will be 2 weeks, 2 months, or a year. But I think there will be a period of time where gold and dollar will rally together. And then ultimately, the dollar will weaken, the dollar will fall, the dollar will go away, and just gold will go through the moon or go to the moon. And I don't know exactly what happened in the early October, but I do know all the markets started kind of changing in that first to second week of October. The oil market, the equity market, the bond market, and the gold market, all of them kind of broke that first or second week of October and have kind of just kind of been all over the place since then.
Well, let me ask a follow-on related question then, because great minds think alike. My view as well has been at some point we're going to get to gold and the dollar both going up together. And my rationale for why that's going to occur is eventually we're going to get into a difficult situation where there's a lot of flight capital that would normally have all gone into bonds. And a lot of it is still going to go into bonds. But the people who, from a mandate perspective, have the choice are going to start to recognize, hey, bonds are in a bubble. This is not a good time to be in bonds. They're going to look for a different safe haven asset. So both the dollar and gold become safe haven assets. So my first question is, that's my rationale. Is that your rationale, or do you have a different reason for thinking that we eventually get to gold and the dollar moving up? But then my second half of my question is, okay, if we both think that's coming someday, and we both can't really explain how something seems to have changed since the middle of October, and we're not sure what it is, how would we rule out the possibility that it's starting earlier than we thought it was going to? And I'm still skeptical, but I'm thinking, something's going on here. How do I determine whether or not something we've both predicted maybe is starting before we thought it was?
This is my answer. And listen, this is not this is my forecast, right? And everybody knows that no forecast is 100%. And if you know somebody tells you they know exactly what's going to happen, you should run the other way very quickly. But I am of the belief that our rates being higher relative to the rest of the world, and the fact that the strong dollar is going to put so much pressure on sovereign debt around the world, that the U.S. is going to get capital flows from the rest of the world. And I think that it's not only going to flow into the dollar and flow into our bonds, I think it's going to flow into our equities. And while I don't necessarily think that the Dow is going to break out right now, it will not surprise me at all if it does. 30,000 on the Dow, I can see that easily happening because of flow of capital. And if that happens, that allows, Powell, I think, to keep raising very slowly. Now, if that strong dollar causes so much problems around the world that not even the U.S. is able to get enough capital flows that it supports our domestic market and our stock market and, our employment and all that kind of stuff, and that continues to worsen, then I think that means that we're much closer to the date that you're talking about than I currently foresee. So that is possible. I can't rule that out. I don't think it's going to happen yet. I think the equity market is, it's had a good correction here. It may go down a little bit more. But I ultimately see the stock market going a lot higher, because I think on a worldwide basis that not only the U.S. dollar, but also U.S. equities will be seen as a safe haven versus emerging market equities versus emerging market debt versus, other currencies around the world.
So, Brent, you're going to be joining us out in Vancouver as one of our guests at the Macro Voices Live. Why don't you share with our listeners what you plan to talk about?
Yeah, basically what I want to talk about is just kind of the structure of the monetary system and kind of really flesh out why I think it is, even though I'm a gold guy, why I think the dollar is going to get so much stronger. And then what I think those knock-on effects are, because I don't want to sound overly dramatic, but I do think that in the next 2 or 3 years, the entire monetary system is going to have to change in some form. Now, maybe it happens a little bit sooner than 2 or 3 years. Maybe it takes a little bit longer, but I just see over the next 2 to 3 years, a big structural change taking place in the monetary system itself. And I think the knock-on effects the markets go through as we proceed towards that date are going to have profound implications for everybody in the world. I know that many people know me through the gold world, and most people in the gold world have this view that the dollar is going to get much weaker. I'm very sympathetic to that view. Ultimately, I think that will happen. But I think what you need to do is kind of really step back. And, I think one of the most important things in markets is to look at the other side and to put yourself in the other person's shoes. But I think one of the hardest things to do is, once you get in their shoes, is most people will do that, but then they still think like themselves. What you have to do is you have to get in their shoes, but then you have to try to think like them as well. And the reality is most of the world does not believe in gold currently. Now, I think that they will at some point, but when you're sitting in their shoes, you need to look at the world and view it as they view it, but then think like they think. And I don't think people are ready to rush to gold yet. I think they will, but I don't think it's going to happen yet. And I think the implications over the next couple of years are enormous.
Brent, thank you so much for joining us on the program. We look forward to catching you on January 19th in Vancouver. Meanwhile, folks, we need your help promoting Macro Voices. So please tell your friends and colleagues, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. It's free. It only takes a minute. We're not going to spam you. We'll just send you our research roundup email, which never contains advertising or marketing. It's just links to the best content we could find for free on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
In this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview and the link to Daniel Want's slide deck. There's also a link to the full Bloomberg interview with Stanley Druckenmiller. And there's a great article on CNN Business on Alan Greenspan warning investors. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that blog or write about the market, and we'd like to share that with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.